Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and Tony Hall of Alaska Newspapers. The Justice Department concludes its investigation of Congressman Don Young. Paul, this investigation lasted several years. What finally happened?
Well, it started in 2006, and about the time that Bill Allen of VICO confessed to the federal authorities that he had given Don Young money for his annual barbecue and golf clubs and that sort of thing. And at about the same time, there was an incident in Florida involving a coconut grove, involving a highway interchange that may or may not have benefited one of his supporters. Congress, actually, the Senate, actually, called the federal...
And that was the question of a proper or improper appropriation.
Exactly right. It was an earmark that left, was approved by the House and the Senate one way, and by the time it got to the president's desk, it was something else altogether. The interchange had come from, it had been a road widening, became a $10 million interchange. So, and while nobody's ever said since 2006 what these investigations are, those are the two things that have been most reported. The feds called this week and said, forget it, we're done. And that's it. Generally, they don't detail, it's been my experience anyway, they don't detail the what's and wherefores or the whys of what they've done. And they just move on and let you pick up the wreckage of your life. So he spent $1.2 million, I guess, in campaign funds defending himself from the investigation. But it looks like the investigation's over.
Steve, what does this mean for Congressman Young's future and for the future of his opponents in the coming election?
Well, the immediate future is the August primary and then perhaps the general election in November. You could look at it two ways. One, it's vindication for, as far as Don Young is concerned. This ordeal is over for him, and he can look at everybody and say, look, you know, they didn't find anything. I'm not being investigated anymore. They didn't take this to court. You know, I've told you all along that I didn't do anything wrong, and there you are. Or he could kind of cringe a little bit at this point at the timing and say, this comes a couple of weeks before the primary election.
Well, his opponents are more or less saying, aha, yeah. Tell us what they didn't accuse you of.
That's right. And it's a reminder right now. Oh, there was an investigation? Well, tell us more about that. So maybe the timing wasn't great. Maybe if this would have come out in maybe early September, it would have worked out a lot better. It would have been a perfect scenario for Congressman Young. But even with this hanging over him, he's been pretty well bulletproof. I mean, no one's really laid a glove on him in these last couple of elections. You had a pretty strong candidate in the Republican primary 2 years ago and won Sean Parnell.
Who's now our governor.
And Don Young won by a comfortable margin. So if he can weather this reminder, I think he's back to being bulletproof. Unless, again, Sheldon Fisher, who's his primary opponent here in the August 24th election, if he can make some hay with it, and he's filed a Freedom of Information Act asking for this information to see what was going on. And the Coconut Road situation too, he wants Congress to reveal what the status is on that, and just what were they looking into in that particular issue. So, yeah, I guess all in all, bottom line, it's going to be favorable news for Congressman Young. And yeah, it does serve as a reminder to voters if they had forgotten.
Thanks. Let's go back to Paul Jenkins. Paul, Congressman Young spent more than $1 million from a special fund that he established. Many campaign contributors and friends contributed to it, and that doesn't seem like an ideal situation. On the other hand, it's hardly ideal to ask Congressman Young to hawk everything he owns to come up with more than $1 million to defend himself. What's a rational way to look at this?
It's an imperfect system. I'm not sure. You have to be a little nervous about where this money comes from. On the other hand, as you pointed out, I mean, it would not be fair to leave him hanging out like that for over $1 million just to defend himself from charges that are dismissed with a phone call. It seems to me that there's somewhere in there, there's a middle ground.
On the other hand, we do know that this happens all the time in the criminal justice system.
Exactly correct. That's correct.
Yeah.
Once they've got you on the hook, you're on the hook.
Steve had another comment here.
The other factor in here too is, did they say there's no criminal wrongdoing here by Congressman Young, the investigators, the Department of Justice? Did it just determine, yeah, we've really looked at this thing thoroughly, and there's nothing here? Or did they say, look what happened with the Ted Stevens situation regarding Bill Allen and Vico?
When you say say, you mean say among themselves.
Among themselves is the conversation, yeah. Is the thought process here. We really can't go into a courtroom and try a case against Congressman Young based on what's happened, where the prosecution, the case against Ted Stevens basically blew up and was dismissed. And then you've had other questions come up in other cases as well.
And the Weirach case is now more than 4 years old.
That's right. There's some real problems here with how the Department of Justice and the FBI handled these cases in the past. And perhaps, I mean, it's a combination of all of these things. There are the prosecutors are a little gun shy about going into a courtroom and try and press this matter against Congressman Young. And perhaps there aren't. There isn't enough there to prosecute him.
Let's get Paul very quickly, though.
I was just going to point out what Steve pointed out, that I think maybe they are gun shy and that they just decided this, what we know and what we can prove are two different things. Mm-hmm. And why go in the courtroom and lose it outright?
Okay. Let's welcome once more Tony Hall of Alaska Newspapers, who hasn't been a guest here for a while. But Tony, for years, coastal Alaskans have been worried about offshore oil spills, and now they've been looking at the what's happened in the Gulf, and you've done some reporting and examining about what would happen to a major oil spill in the Alaska Arctic waters if it was similar to what we've seen there, a blowout. What do you think?
Well, the timing for this, we have a story in this month's First Alaskans magazine examining this. Arctic Clean Seas is a industry co-op organization, basically that is responsible for dealing with, would be responsible for dealing with oil spill and oil spill preparedness in the Arctic. They had done testing in 2008 and 2009 that was published earlier this year, showing what sort of differences exist between having a spill in the Gulf of Mexico and having a spill where offshore oil drilling would be taking place in Alaska. And what they found out basically was ice is nice. It provides a lot of advantages. Nobody wants an oil spill. But if you're going to have an oil spill, having an oil spill where there is ice does give you some advantages in dealing with it. We see in the Gulf of Mexico this in situ process of containing the oil spill, burning the oil in place. What the ice does, what this research done in 2008 and 2009 in the Barents Sea off of the north coast of Norway, what that showed was that the ice can act as a buffer to contain the spill, and it also, the cold temperatures and the ice slows down evaporation. So that enables crews to get in there and deal with it, have more time to respond, essentially.
Okay, thank you very much, Tony. Paul, a little more than 2 weeks remain, a little bit more than 2 weeks, before the primary election. What can you see from your perch here in Anchorage as we approach the last couple of weeks?
Well, I've been out of state for a couple of weeks in the sunshine and the heat, so I come back. It looked pretty slow. I guess I expected more ads, more verbiage, more out-and-out fighting than I'm seeing.
The fewer ads would reflect less money, wouldn't it?
Well, I would think so, yeah. Or they're waiting if the next 2 weeks is when they would spend the money anyway. So I don't know. I'm not impressed with these. This is not
Paul,
the norm.
Paul, I have news for you. This campaign is not designed to make you happy.
It's supposed to make me happy. That's right. No, there's. It's more quiet. I think the GOP gubernatorial race is fairly well defined. We've got Sean Parnell acting as an incumbent and trying to stay out of it, and then the other two are busily trying not to kill each other off or look like bums while they're doing it. There's a lot of good information coming out of these campaigns, but not much in the way of fire and brimstone.
Steve, yeah. Modern campaigns are frequently won or lost on television.
Yep.
In fact, that's the way most voters in most states meet most of the candidates. What can we say about this campaign as a television event?
Yeah, right now,
given your experience, which is vast in television.
I agree with Paul. It's been kind of slow, and there's been a couple of moments that that maybe have been telling, have been kind of fun to watch. The cameos that we see, there's the Jay Ramirez, and then there's the Mead Treadwell. They kind of have Parnell pop up in his spot. And so that kind of hints, I think, they're looking for that, I'm the anointed one to run with Sean Parnell kind of thing. Because he is the front runner, I think, in the governor's race. So we've seen that one. Maybe the more inventive ones, the ones with laced a little more vinegar, the Joe Miller spots that he's running against Lisa Murkowski with the moose horns and things. That's kind of
fun. That's very Alaskan. In the grand tradition of Jay Hammond, here we have Joe Miller walking through the woods in his red and black checked shirt.
Very Alaskan.
Very Alaskan. our viewers outside, if anybody's watching this outside by their computer or some other device, mm-hmm. if you want to see real Alaskan advertising, this is what you need to watch as he tosses the moose antlers from side to side to indicate, that's the way Lisa Murkowski sheds her position.
Just drops them in the woods. We haven't seen any Rhode Island red spots or anything like that. That classic Bill Sheffield versus Tom Fink back in 1982, that did win him the election. If you ask Tom Fink to this day what was the deciding factor in the 1982 governor's race, he'll tell you Rhode Island red, that little spot of in South Central was left behind as the only spot that that Sheffield was claiming Fink really cared about in the state of Alaska. So about the size of Rhode Island, what the copy said. So that was that's probably the classic campaign spot of all time, in my opinion,
Paul,
in Alaska.
Another difference in this campaign, I think. In the past, the news media up here has been very, very active in these campaigns. We've had truth detection stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They get campaign ads and shred them to come up with the truth and that sort of thing. We don't see that anymore. We're not seeing anybody probing. We're not seeing anybody taking the shots that tend to set these things off. So these guys are getting a free ride. That's what's happening.
But have they really said anything other than
no.
the shedding of the horns thing?
No.
But they haven't really said it. Yeah. I mean, we've seen lots of kids. Kids are popular themes in campaign spots,
And, dogs.
Well, Miller's been very aggressive. I mean, his advertising mm-hmm. notes the hundreds of times Lisa Murkowski has voted with the Democrats. I'm confident that most of those will be pro forma votes if somebody really looked carefully at it. But mm-hmm. And they've pitched that kind of thing strong.
Yeah. Miller, obviously, he's got to make a name for himself in those things. So he really has to go long ball on these things.
Yes,
because
that's correct.
He doesn't have the name recognition. He's trying to
or
the money. He's trying to unseat a popular incumbent. He does have the Tea Party people behind him. I'm waiting for those folks to unleash and see what they come up with. But you would think that Ralph Samuels and Bill Walker would unleash some ads here real soon too, because they are running out of time. And if you believe in all the polls right now, it does appear that Parnell is the front runner. Right.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about what I saw this week.
Mm-hmm.
This week I went to the Republican gubernatorial debate before the Resource Development Council. The three candidates appeared and answered questions with regard to resource development, everything from pebble mine to oil development, timber, the whole works, and tourism as well. There are two ways that you can look at this. One, the three major candidates outlined in detail their views of what they would do as governor in resource development, or they told the audience exactly what they wanted to hear. You can be the judge of that. Governor Parnell presented himself as the man with the steady hand on the tiller who has handled the state for the last year and will continue to do that in a steady, undramatic fashion. Bill Walker presents himself as the can-do guy who's going to build the gas line. The first day he gets into office, he's going to start working on that gas line, and that's the first thing he's going to do, and we're going to have it, and it's time to stop talking about it. And Ralph Samuels presents himself as a man who stepped in to provide leadership in dangerous times. It's only 3 or 4 years from now, 4 years, I think Ralph Samuels says, before we'll really be in trouble because the throughput of the Alaska pipeline has become so low and we're not producing as much oil. And it's time to put an end to this anti-business environment that we have in Alaska. So that's more or less the summary of the choices you have in the Republican primary. And we'll see more of them, and you can see the ads, whatever you want. Tony Hall, it's been 50 years, and I find this hard to believe, since the state of Alaska and the federal government have updated the map of Alaska. But now they're spending some big money to give us a map that's more accurate, and I mean, this is not a trivial matter. In some cases, it might even save lives. Tony, what can you tell us?
Yeah, it's really, really pretty amazing when you think about it, Michael, that Even though we don't have, we never got any bridges to nowhere, we seem to have maps to nowhere.
That's pretty good.
One of the people working on this project noted that on Alaska maps, you can have mountains that are 3 miles off from where they're actually located. And another person involved noted deaths of 13 different aviators who he knew personally because they didn't have accurate mapping to rely on. So what is happening now is they're using jets. There's three outside contractors who are involved in this. They're mapping the state grid by grid, square by square. They have mapped a section from Fort Yukon to portion of South Central, but basically that's 15% of the project so far. But what they're doing is they're flying at 40,000 feet, shooting radar that's cloud penetrating, and going grid by grid in this 3-year project that ultimately is going to save lives.
And in 3 years, it'll be done? Is that what you're saying, Tony?
Yeah, that's what the plan is.
Okay. Let's stick with you, Tony. It's summer in Alaska, and one of the perennial problems in summer Alaska is dust. But now some villages have programs to reduce the amount of dust, which is not a trivial matter. It can affect health. Please tell us about it.
Well, this is something that's been evolving for some time. There were studies done in 2001 by the Department of Environmental Conservation showing a unhealthy level or a level exceeding the national standard for particulate pollution in 8 villages: Buckland, Ambler, Bethel, Kiana, Kotzebue, Noatak, Norvik, and St. Mary's. So from 2001 to 2008, the legislature appropriates $650,000 to address this. Now, this summer, that money has been used to acquire trailers with downward sprays, and they're using water, they're using different chemicals in these villages to see what works best. Problem with water is you get a hot summer day, it evaporates, and it doesn't pay the freight to have the trucks continue to go out and out again. So very, very experimental. They're just trying to find out what works. The chemicals that they're using, state said they looked closely and came up with a list of things that had they'd gone over and had good details on toxicity and how they affect the environment. So, but there, a lot of the money has already been spent. 60-70% of the money for this was eaten up in just getting the trailers to the site. So they're going to be looking for more money from the state in order to continue this.
And will they keep the trailers there over the winter, or how are they going to do this?
They probably will. I didn't get an indication of that. But with the shipping cost being as high as it is, that would make sense.
And over the winter, they'll get reports, and they'll look at the reports, and they'll decide what's to be done next and if to expand. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, thank you very much, Tony. The ACLU files a lawsuit claiming there is a discrimination in tax policy against same-sex partners. Paul, you want to tell us about the lawsuit, the issue, and where do we go from here?
Supreme Court. The state years ago came up with a $150,000 exemption for elderly married people and disabled veterans. It's $150,000 for two people. The gay community is saying, well, We have couples, we're considered roommates because we're not allowed to marry. So therefore, when we live together and both of our names are on the mortgage, that sort of thing, they only get one half of that exemption, $75,000. They claim it's a violation of the Constitution, equal protection provision. And they probably have a case. It's going to be a long fight, but this one will wind up at the Alaska Supreme Court, if not the federal Supreme Court.
Steve, one of the things that strikes me is I'm like many, many people of our viewers in the audience who know gay people who feel this very strong, and not only in the pocketbook, but as in their estimation, a moral matter, and they'll point out, I have no rights as to be my partner's family member. If they're hospitalized, the person can't get health benefits off me, from me, or share my health benefits, trying to find the right verb here. It would seem to me that there is an audience out there that would be sympathetic. At the same time, we know there's going to be resistance.
Yes. And this, we've passed a constitutional amendment in this state recognizing that a marriage is between a man and a woman. Some years ago, voters did that in an overwhelming fashion. There will be some support out there for these couples. There'll be some sympathy for these couples as well. And this is a defining, or this has the potential to be a very defining moment in Alaska law. As Paul says, it's certainly going to make it to the Alaska Supreme Court.
And if that is the case, we can be certain that that's going to take a while.
It'll take years to play out. But this is something that potentially could change law.
It would be very difficult to argue that you should immediately expedite the case.
Well, yeah, I would think so. I don't think there's really I don't know what the reason would be to expedite at this particular point in time. The couples that are involved are all in their 60s, so they're getting up there in age. They're still pretty young,
They're really young.
Yes, but this could take a while. I don't know what the reason would be to expedite the case. I suppose
you could make the argument, and somebody might, that the people, the affected parties, are suffering the consequences now and shouldn't have to suffer longer.
Right. Yeah, because they are losing out, if that's indeed the case.
Paul.
Yes.
Some of this might wind up moot. I mean, the California federal judge this week tossed out that state's ban on gay marriage. That's going to the Supreme Court for sure. Mm-hmm. Nobody is sure exactly what that court. This may not be the best court for that particular case from the gay community anyway. Mm-hmm. But if they read the law, they read the law. And by the time we get this resolved, it may be resolved somewhere else.
That's true.
Well, and I think that what we're going to face here is that there'll be some kind of eventually federal standard. Don't you think that's
what we're going to have? I think that is exactly what's going to happen. This will go to the Supreme Court. This will be resolved there, one way or the other. Mm-hmm.
Paul, while you were gone, the fill the boot battle seemed to have ended. But now that you're back, you're not back?
I am back. I'm not really back. I'm just here. That's all.
Okay.
No.
Is this finally over or not?
The fill the boot thing?
Yes.
Well, what we have now is we've got, of course.
And for those who are just checked in at their hotel, fill the boot in 12 seconds.
Oh, my God. Okay. Well, on duty city firefighters were helping the Muscular Dystrophy Association with the Fill the Boot charity drive. They stand on corners, take money in their boots. Mayor's office.
Thank you. That's good.
Excuse me. Yeah. Okay. You got it. No. The mayor is putting together a policy now on what city employees can do, what his city employees can do, his administration employees can do, and that is supposed to be out sometime, I think, early next week. And all expectations are that it's going to say that city employees are encouraged to help charities on their own time.
Okay, and that is going to be a regulation?
It'll be the policy of the mayor.
Okay, the administrative policy. For his employees, then, right? Okay, Tony Hall, Economic Development in Rural Alaska, the federal government has a $2.2 million program to grow various Alaska seeds in the Alaska seed industry. Tell us about this unusual approach to economic development.
Well, if I can you can call this a grassroots effort for job creation.
Ooh,
I was afraid of that.
Good try.
Yeah. But what they're doing, the state has the project called the Rural Village Seed Production Project, and what they're hoping to do is to they're talking with different opinion leaders in villages, and from Metlakatla to Monarch, and looking at this as an opportunity to have people to go out collect native seeds. You can get $50 for a pound of fireweed seeds. You bring them to a centralized production facility in 4 to 5 regional areas in the state, process them, and get money in return. So very much at the front end of this right now, still looking for more villages and more interest. So
could you give us an example here? We only have a few seconds, Tony, of a village where they might be doing this, or a couple of villages where they might be doing this.
Well, they have talked with Metlakatla, talked with Imanik, and they say that they have received 20, what we reported at that time, 20 inquiries from other places so far, but still looking for more.
Okay, we can't take any more inquiries ourselves because we are about out of time. Please join us next week on Anchorage Edition. Thank you.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.